Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. The longer the U.S.-Israel war of aggression on Iran goes on, the fewer good options are available to end it. In fact, with every passing day, the war widens horizontally. While the American administration continues to claim victory, it is being forcibly pushed out of the Middle East. To discuss the ongoing war, I'm joined by Mohammed Mirandi in Tehran. He is a professor at the University of Tehran. A warm welcome back to the program. We've been doing this for 15 years now, and it's a pleasure to have you just one-on-one for a change here. So I'm going to start quickly with I'm sure you saw some of the Senate clips of the Senate hearing with the person that claims to be the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth. And I want to just start out very broadly in watching it, and he was grilled. Yes, it was, but it was very partisan, Democrats and all of that, which is very. I don't get involved in the intramural struggles of the American political party because it's basically a monoparty when it comes to foreign policy. But I'm sure it didn't go amiss on your part that there was no talk of the origins of the war against Iran. There was no discussion of really the Israeli involvement. And even more broadly, there was no discussion of the Israelization of American foreign policy in West Asia. Those are the things you can't talk about in pleasant company in Western media. Take it away, Professor.
Well, first of all, it's a great honor being on your show always, and it's a particularly great honor being with you for a one-on-one discussion. Yes, you're right, and that is where the problem lies at the end of the day. The problem lies in those issues which cannot be discussed, whether in the Senate or in the House or in a committee or in mainstream media. No one is going to say that. We haven't seen a single person in senator say that we're carrying out an act of aggression. Yeah. This war was unprovoked. You don't see Western media, anyone, any of the major pundits say that we are killing children. We are an aggressor. We are destroying yet, or attempting to destroy yet another country. That's not the narrative, because American exceptionalism, George, sort of like Zionism, gives you special rights and privileges. So when you destroy a country, when I destroy a country, I'm not guilty of war crimes. It's at most a mistaken policy. It was bad judgment when I killed a million people. But if you carry out an assault on an old lady walking down the street, you go to jail. You can go to jail for life. But if they destroy an entire country, we didn't find weapons of mass destruction. It was a mistake. Yes, next time we should be more careful. That is the mentality. And so that's why the empire is going to collapse, because they cannot see, or they are not willing to see, the root of the problem. And the Israeli regime is dragging the United States down to hell. They went into Afghanistan, spent trillions of dollars. They went into Iraq, spent trillions of dollars. They destroyed Libya. They destroyed Syria. Now they're going after Iran after they've lost so many trillions of dollars, and they're on the decline, whereas the rest of the world, they're behaving like normal countries, China developing, Russia trying to develop, BRICS countries, Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries, all trying to develop, whereas Americans are constantly waging war. Well, wealth isn't infinite. Mm. And now we're seeing when reality hits. So yeah. The Iranians...
Yeah, well, let's talk about that reality here. If you consume Western media, the United States is... won this war over and over and over again, apparently. But the Strait of Hormuz is still under Iranian control. And with every passing night, and they talk about, how horrible it's going to be for Iran with every passing night, it seems to me the news that the Western audiences are not getting is that there are fewer and fewer operational American bases in the Persian Gulf. They're all being clustered now in Jordan, and sooner or later, they're going to have to move to Israel. They don't talk about the facts on the ground, except for the we're winning, we have won. I mean, how many times is the United States and Israel going to lose this war?
In normal circumstances, when you go from Kuwait and then you go to Jordan and then you go to the Israeli regime, they would call that retreat.
Yeah.
But yeah. in the United States, that term does not exist. They should have learned from the 40 days of war, during the Ramadan war, as they say here, that they can't defeat Iran. I mean, they murdered the leader. Ayatollah Khamenei was martyred. Senior commanders were martyred. The combined force of the United States and the Israeli regime hit day and night. They achieved nothing. They began with unconditional surrender. And then by the end of the war, they accepted the Iranian 10-point plan as the framework for negotiations. That didn't work. Then they went and imposed a siege on Iran, saying, we're going to bring them to their knees. Senators went on TV saying, they have no food, they're starving, with pleasure. Of course, it was nonsense. I mean, there was inflation, there was difficulty, but not that sort of difficulty. But they were taking pleasure in their, in their imaginary victory. That didn't work. They had to sign ultimately an MOU where everyone was saying was a capitulation. But now they want to do it all over again. And we're seeing that the Iranians are actually hitting harder,
yep,
and with greater precision. And in addition to that, because of the foolishness of the Saudi regime by bombing Yemen's international airport, Sana'a International Airport, the Yemenis are now involved in the war. And we're seeing the price of oil rising very rapidly. So this is. Obviously not going to lead to victory. And if Trump does carry out his threats, because he keeps saying he's going to demolish Iranian infrastructure, bridges and power plants, if he does that, the Iranians have said that they're going to take out the critical infrastructure of those regimes that are facilitating the war in the Persian Gulf. It is the month of July, and you and I know what that means in the Arabian Peninsula. If the Iranians take out the critical infrastructure, everyone will have to leave. These countries, yes, will collapse. And that means a global economic depression worse than the 1930s. And we know what happened after that.
You know, the terminology that we keep hearing from Western politicians and echoed by the media, I was particularly interested in the following new term here, functionally defeated. What in the world is that supposed to mean? Because, I mean, that could be applied to the United States if I can figure out what that really means. But Iran has been functionally defeated, but it is still able to launch missiles and drones with amazing precision, a precision that has only gotten better as this conflict continues. So, I mean, where does this come from, functionally defeated?
It's just like how they pick the movement of U.S. assets away from the Persian Gulf to Jordan and then to Israel. It is probably advancing westwards.
Okay. Making... okay. Well, you said in a previous interview, which I really thought it was interesting, with Danny or with the judge, but you said the only option Iran has is to fight. Can you explain more what that means?
Well, we tried everything else.
There you go.
I mean, we had an MOU, and then the Iranians knew that the United States would not abide by the commitment. I mean, I don't recall ever speaking to anyone in Tehran during the past few weeks after the MOU where people said, yes, they're going to do this or that. But from the very beginning, the Americans did not force the Israeli regime to leave Lebanon or to stop the killing. They did not hand over Iranian stolen assets. They continued to threaten Iranian leaders and the Iranian people, a violation of the deal. They expanded the sanctions regime, another violation. Mm-hmm. They lifted the sanctions on Iranian oil, then reversed it after a few days, another violation. And then they violated Article 5 and by trying to create a corridor in the Strait of Hormuz, whereas in Article 5, it was clear that the Iranians would manage the Strait of Hormuz and Iran would normalize it. Why did the Americans do this? With the collaboration of the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Kuwaitis, who are their partners in war. They did it to undermine Iran's position in the Strait of Hormuz so that they can control the Strait. Iran would have no leverage, and then they would win the war despite losing it on the battlefield and in siege warfare. And the Iranians said, no, we're not going to allow you to do that. So the Americans violated all of their commitments. Then they attacked Iran and reimposed the siege. So what else is Iran going to do? This, and you know, the debate that exists in Iran today is whether we should have even signed the MOU. I mean, some are saying we did the right thing. We took that opportunity to quickly export tens of millions of barrels of oil and import critical goods to prepare ourselves for today. Others were saying, no, we should have continued. Both arguments have their own merit. I don't think one side is completely correct or the other. But the point is that no one is saying, let's do a deal, let's do a ceasefire, that's just out of the question. And ultimately, whenever this comes to an end, and it will come to an end at some point, we may be in a global economic depression and the global economy will collapse, or it may be something else. It's going to be worse, whatever it is. It could be horribly worse or just much worse or somewhat worse. But whatever happens at the end, when the Iranians and the Americans come to some sort of agreement, the Iranian demands will be more than what we saw in the MOU. It will include Yemen. It will include Gaza more explicitly. And the Iranians will want things up front. So the Americans are in a lose-lose situation. The smartest thing that they could have done was to implement the MOU and move on. But the Zionists, lobby, the Israeli regime won't allow it. And Trump's ego, if you add that to it, that makes it more than enough to wreck the global economy and the U.S. economy and
you know,
the world.
You know, we've often, when as you guessed on this program, we've made the comparison, this conflict with the comparison in Ukraine. And you're absolutely right. The longer it goes on, the more the Americans are going to lose. The longer the conflict goes on in Ukraine, the more they will lose. Should take the deal and be honest up front, and all sides can get past it. But again, agreement incapable. And the United States shows that around the world, and particularly when they come across a power that can say no. Russia says no. Iran says no. On that note, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the ongoing war on Iran. Stay with RT.
See, you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're gonna brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Brilliant. I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
In the warm spring of 1945, it felt as though world peace had come for good.
They are determined to be united with each other and with all peace-loving nations, because the ideal of lasting peace become a reality.
I think the Cold War began with the death of Roosevelt, and Churchill was a Cold War warrior.
Churchill, der hatte die Idee, Russland mit Hilfe der deutschen Kriegsgefangenen, das waren 100.000 Mann, nach dem Motto:
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Operation Unthinkable and Pincer and Broiler and Bushwhacker and Dropshot, I mean, all of these were essentially plans to directly attack and destroy the Soviet Union.
Why did the peace so many had longed for give way to a new, protracted war? When exactly did the post-war world take a fateful turn?
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the ongoing war on Iran. Okay, Professor Moran, just briefly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because I think I don't see the value of so-called negotiations, considering what Americans call negotiations before the 12-day war, before the Ramadan war, that means nothing to them. It is just it's deceiving. Their interlocutor in this case of Iran, but there's been mentioned a 10-day ceasefire. Is there any credence to that? I mean, I find that hard to believe, considering the negotiating style, if we can put it that way, of the United States and the Israelis. Any value to a 10-day ceasefire?
No. The Iranians are not interested in ceasefire at all. And the Iranians have said to the Pakistanis and the Omanis and the others who are all seeking some sort of dialogue or some sort of movement towards an agreement.
Yeah, well, the mediators have their own interests. We would have
exactly. Okay. And the Iranians have been saying, "Look, go and talk with Americans. We're not the ones who." Destroyed the MOU. We're not the ones who violated the MOU. They did. So, and the Iranians are not going to accept any ceasefire now. The Iranians are going to continue the war until the Americans are, the Trump regime suffers enough where they come to the conclusion that this just can't continue. Remember, and I know you remember this, it's just rhetorical, but when Trump signed the MOU and everyone was attacking him for basically capitulating to Iran, he said that, look, we're just 4 weeks away from emptying our reserves. Do you want me to be a Herbert Hoover? Do you want a Great Depression? So obviously, the United States is not in an ideal situation. Trump is not, he does not have endless reserves of oil. And the Iranians know that. It may not be 4 weeks, it may be 5 weeks, it may be 3 weeks, it may be 6 weeks, but there is serious trouble lying ahead. And so the Iranians are not going to have a ceasefire now when they know that nothing will come of it. The Iranians want the United States to ultimately go back to the MOU plus. In other words, they have to implement the deal, but they have to add new things. And that would include Gaza and Yemen. The siege on Yemen would have to be lifted, and Americans would have to give things up front. Iran is not going to enter a ceasefire and then wait for the Americans to hand over stolen assets, which it will never do. The problem is, and you know this better than I, and it's just like the Russian issue. The problem is that the Americans engage in wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. Remember how Russia was running out of missiles, and you had to open up all the washing machines and take out the chips and all that. That's what they're now saying about Iran. Iran is running out of missiles, and then Iran is firing missiles and drones day and night, but they say, no, they're running out of missiles. It's all wishful thinking. And ultimately, as far as I know, you've run out of washing machines, but you have not run out of missiles in Russia. And the same is true in Iran. It's all about narratives, and holding down the price of oil through manipulation. That's narrative. But ultimately, when that shortage hits the market, people find out that there is not enough oil anymore. It's going to get very bad. And you know, Peter, actually, by manipulating the market and bringing down the price of oil, they're making it worse for themselves. Mm-hmm. Because they are preventing demand destruction. They are making people continue to use up as much oil as they were a year ago instead of trying to decrease consumption to manage the crisis. They're moving full steam ahead, and then when suddenly they're going to hit that shortage, it's going to be worse than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, but it's the same people that will, they're just going to the bank every single day collecting their ill-gotten gains here. And they don't care. If they cared about their own people, I'm speaking of the Americans, they never would have sent them to war. And people are beginning to realize that indefinitely the commitment of this regime in America is to enrich itself. There's no doubt about it. They keep doing it over and over again. I'm going to ask you a very hard question right now, because, you know, we see what has happened through this conflict, the first 40 days, then this fake MOU, and then, I don't know, we're on day 13 or something like that of the return of kinetic action. But Iran is in the position to strike Jordan very hard, strike Israel very hard. I mean, we know that the director of Ben-Gurion Airport was saying, get these American planes out of here, because it's a huge target, an easy target. Why doesn't Iran take the initiative and push the inevitable conclusion of this conflict to an end?
Well, before I answer that, Peter, I just want to point out that there's a famous statement that's attributed to Marie Antoinette, and it's not true, but it's still famous. And that was when, you know, people were facing hunger. And they said, there's no bread, which she asked, what's going on? They said, there's no bread. And he said, well, then let them eat cake. Again, this she didn't actually say this, in, historically speaking, but it's a famous quote. These people who don't care about the American people, these American leaders or these elites, this Epstein class, they shouldn't be so confident about their position. If things get very bad for the United States, the American people are going to be very, very angry. And, you know, Peter, and this is, I'm not a sociologist, I'm just speculating. In a country that experienced poverty for decades, wherever in the world, a country that is poor and it remains poor, people may be dissatisfied. But a country which, when I was young, was a rich country and moves downwards towards poverty, I think the anger in that sort of country is going, the wrath of the people will be something to be fearful of. But with regards to...
Well, on that point, Mohammed, the America is quite exceptional in the case that it has a lot of guns, okay? I'm agreeing with you, of course. Go ahead, continue.
Oh, absolutely. But I think actually we are moving in that direction. The Israeli regime is in a more precarious situation today than it was 12 days ago, 13 days ago. Why? Because all those radar systems in the Persian Gulf, yeah, in northern Iraq, in Jordan, they're all destroyed. And those air defense systems, they're all designed basically for Israel. The Americans don't care about anyone else but the Israeli regime. Right now the Israelis are saying, let the Americans fight for us. I mean, we don't want to get involved. Which is the biggest insult possible to the American people. And in return, what does the United States do? They merge the U.S. armed forces with the armed forces of the Israeli regime, like the obedient slaves that they are in the House and the Senate. But ultimately, when all these are destroyed, Iranian missiles and Iranian drones, and particularly Iranian drones, will have a much easier time striking the regime. Right now, Iran is in no rush to strike Israel because of the elections in the Israeli regime and because of the internal crisis that exists there. The hostility among the different factions in the regime is very high. And in the Hebrew press, when you look at it, I see it sometimes through Conflicts Forum, they do good translations. They even talk about civil war. So when your enemy is busy destroying itself, the Iranians will say, let's see how this plays out.
Professor Morandi, one last question, because we're unfortunately rapidly running out of time. Our mutual friend Max Blumenthal, you saw him during his visit during the funeral procession. He spoke to people, and some of the responses he got is that there is a new Islamic revolution occurring. How would you reflect upon that? I mean, is it very nationalistic? How much religiosity is part of that? But a new or reinvigorated revolution, how would you reflect upon that?
I would agree. I don't think that in Iran, nationalism and religion are separate. They're very much mixed. It's one identity. They come together in Iran. You know, in Shia Islam, supporting the oppressed, fighting, standing up against the oppressor is very important. If anyone reads Alistair Crook's book, Resistance, they get a good idea. Or Going to Tehran by the Flint and Hillary Leverett, I think they get a better understanding of that. This sense of resilience and resistance is very powerful among Iranians. And after what the United States did, it has grown much stronger. And the Iranians, many Iranians who were worried about what would happen if a war of aggression would start, they found out that actually we were much stronger than they had imagined. And so this resilience, this sense of pride has been enhanced. And of course, it's a country which is founded upon thousands of years of civilization. The Americans have made a catastrophic, Trump has made a catastrophic mistake.
Yeah, and he's good. He's paying the price right now. What we really need to wait for is if the U.S.-Israel relationship will change. But as you pointed out, merging the two in militaries and intelligence, that doesn't give anyone any hope, because it'll give Israel the front seat. It'll be the driver of American foreign policy. That's the last thing the American people need. But you're absolutely right. You mentioned Americans being angry about a lower standard of living. It was going on even before this. Now this will be compounded. And given the media space, alternative space, it's very easy to find out why. It's, you know, what we talked about 15 years ago was a foreboding in Western media. Now on the edges, people are hearing this, and that's why we have to continue our dialogue that started so long ago, which of course will continue into the future. We very much, here at Crosstalk, we very, very much appreciate you as a guest, particularly this time as a one-on-one. So I want to thank you, and of course I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.